Welcome to Pathways. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Every Sunday morning at this time, we invite you to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. Today on Pathways, we are visiting with Bo Lozov, co-founder of the Human Kindness Foundation and its award-winning Prison Ashram Project. Bo has lectured in hundreds of prisons, universities, churches, and spiritual centers around the world, and was named by Utney Reader as one of America's 100 Spiritual Visionaries. Bo is the author of numerous books, including It's a Meaningful Life, It Just Takes Practice, which includes 26 practices to awaken us to a deeper, more joyful life, and We're All Doing Time, a book that includes letters between Bo and prisoners in our penitentiaries. Good morning, Bo, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Good morning.
Can you tell us about your Prison Ashram Project? What exactly is that?
Well, at this point, the Prison Ashram Project began in 1973 when my sister's husband was serving a long prison sentence and my wife and I were living in an ashram. And at this point, the Prison Ashram Project is the largest interfaith spiritual prison ministry in the world. And we maintain a mailing list of about 50,000 people at any given time and send copies of our newsletters and books and CDs and tapes out around the world. I also do a lot of workshops in prisons, and that's what I'm doing here in Portland at this point. I was just in OSP the other day in Coffee Creek and Shutter Creek and several of your institutions. And basically, we're a friendly interfaith resource for prisoners to be able to use their time in a deeper way than just walking around every day as a convict.
So I know that you're currently on a tour. You're based in North Carolina, and you've driven over 10,000 miles on this trip. Here you are in Oregon. Is that the normal MO? I mean, do you just constantly travel around the country visiting prisons?
Well, I do right now, and it may be for the next several years. I don't know. This is the biggest tour that I've done in the last 12 years because I've been working more in North Carolina, building community there, and working with people coming out on parole and that sort of thing. So this is now a rejuvenation of my going out into prisons directly, and I'm hitting hundreds of them on this trip.
And how did the name Prison Ashram Project come up?
Well, we were in an ashram at the time. My brother-in-law was in a prison, and we were waking up at 5 in the morning wearing all white, working on a farm all day without getting paid and not having sex and not going to restaurants. And we go to visit him on the prison farm, and he's getting up at 5 in the morning and wearing all white and working hard on a farm all day without getting paid and not having any sex he wanted to tell us about and not going to restaurants. And we realized that we were peripherally involved with the drug smuggling deal that he had gotten busted for, and realized that he got busted, we got away. And a couple years afterward, here we are living in some senses in a very similar way, but he's doing it bitterly and grudgingly, and we're giving up all the freedoms that he'd give his right arm to have because we're getting something out of it. So it's like the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup commercial, you know, the chocolate and the peanuts just bang together, and you got the Prison Ashram Project. And we never sat down and said we're going to devote the rest of our lives to working with prisoners. We just said we should offer prisoners who are interested the perspective of why people throughout the ages have given up some of those outer freedoms to go into a more restricted environment and live like this, and what they get out of it.
Well, obviously, it's one thing to give up those choices voluntarily and quite another to be forced into it. Do you find that it's that the Prison Ashram Project has been successful in terms of helping prisoners turn their attitude around about their reality?
Oh, sure. I mean, I wouldn't be doing it 33 years later if it weren't. We have hundreds of thousands of prisoners through the years who have experienced the kind of transformation that Saul of Tarsus experienced to become St. Paul. I mean, people are good, and most people really want a better shot at life. And although their freedoms were taken away from them, and ashramites or monks or nuns give up theirs voluntarily, once you're inside that cloistered, restricted environment, well, you're here, so how are you going to use it? It doesn't matter what got you here. Mm-hmm. How are you going to use this? And we're in an ironic period of our civilization, because one of my messages when I go inside and talk with prisoners is, listen, you know, the day you were sentenced is like the train of society came to a stop, opened the doors, and threw your butt out. And you felt rejected, you were isolated, you were exiled, and then the train of society went on without you. Well, I'm coming back in to tell you now, guess what? You know that train that threw you off? It wrecked. And it threw you off before it wrecked. And you actually now have a leg up on most of the people out there, because there's two serious addictions going on in America right now. And I use the word addiction very clinically. There's a serious addiction to rampant consumerism that has made people feel weak, disempowered, really needy and entitled. And there's an equally serious addiction to overstimulation, not being able to just focus on one thing at a time anymore, people being busier beyond belief, and cell phones and laptops and Blackberries and Xboxes. And so I say to prisoners, they threw you off that train. You've been in here for the last however many years you've been here. You're not able to buy a product or hire an expert every time you have a problem. And so you've had to reach in and find inner strength to solve your own problems. You're not able to overstimulate your senses, and you can't spend money in here. And so you're not able to have this partial attention syndrome, is what one psychologist is calling it. And like I walked into Soledad Chapel a few weeks ago, and the security was giving me a hard time. So I was an hour late for my workshop into the chapel. I walk into the chapel. There's 200 men sitting quietly. Little conversations going on here and there, but a calm and quiet room. And I just thought to myself, that's interesting. If I were an hour late to any church, any university, any spiritual center, an hour late for my talk, it wouldn't be a calm and patient and quiet room at all. Everybody would be using that time to catch up with a little work on their laptop or return their calls on their cell phone or be outraged that I wasn't there. Because we treat prisoners so terribly, you know, like you tell a prisoner, you have a doctor's appointment at 9:30 this morning, go sit in that chair. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody walks by and says, what are you doing in that chair? I was supposed to have a doctor's appointment 5 hours ago. He's not coming today. Get out. But what's happened in those 5 hours, that guy's been sitting there with nothing to do. He's had to develop patience, and he's had to learn how to remain calm. And so now I go into prison populations. I find calm, strong men with self-dignity, and women. I was in Coffee Creek the other day. People who have learned the hard way how to be calm, how to have self-dignity, how not to rely on constant buying and using. And out on the streets, you don't find that. So I come into prisons, I say, guess what? This train that threw you off wrecked. It's a serious wreck. There's more antidepressant prescriptions written for Americans than any other country in the world. There's American children are statistically the most homicidal and suicidal children who have ever been born anywhere. And so we need your influence. We need you to remind your family and friends outside how to be calm and patient, how not to be constantly needy for a product or an expert, how not to have to be occupied all the time, how to learn how to wait, how to learn to be patient. And people's ears perk up, you know, that, my God, I hadn't noticed, but I have developed some strength while I've been in here. I have, you know. Your guys in Oregon all wear blue. Your prisoners all wear blue. And so I tell them, here's a practical expression of what I'm talking about. When you get out of prison, here's the biggest act of patriotism and the greatest act for your family that you could do. Make your first item of clothing that you buy in the free world a blue shirt. Show them. Blue wasn't your problem. You're not a rabid dog just waiting to get out and get dressed in fancy clothes. And, you know, why don't you tell your family the best things in life are free, you know? When's the last time you heard a serious American adult, like a teacher or a minister, say the best things in life are free? Nobody believes it anymore. But the only good things the prisoners have gotten in the whole 10, 15, 20 years they've been in prison have been the free things, the connections between human beings, the inner work in themselves, the quiet times with God.
And, it kind of reminds me of the tradition that they have in countries like Thailand, Buddhist countries, where every able-bodied man, young man, goes to the monastery for a certain period of time.
Yeah, for a period of time.
And there's this sensory deprivation that goes along with that, as those of us who've been to monasteries know. I'll never forget when I came back from Asia, having spent time in monasteries, how quiet I was compared to how gregarious I had been before I went anywhere to other countries where they don't necessarily speak English.
That just gives you a wider range of choice when you're that quiet. You definitely get busier again, but do you have to get frenetically busy? Do you have to get, you know, fanatically busy? You have a reference point. Mm-hmm. You know, gee, I felt better when I was quieter. And so I help prisoners gain that reference point and make sure that they realize some of the good stuff that has gone on. Absolutely not because of the prison system. Prison systems are horrible and they're run terribly. But the good stuff they developed in themselves as a result of being put in those unfair, adverse situations.
Yeah, those of us that have voluntarily gone and had a taste of the monastic life can attest to the joyfulness of simplicity.
Yeah.
Then that's probably
the
kinds of things that you tell them, right?
Yeah, they've been forced to live in that simplicity.
What do you think are the fundamental problems in American prisons?
The prisons themselves. I mean, it's just crazy. You know, prisons are creations of they're political footballs and they're media footballs, and has nothing to do with what works. Has nothing to do with the appropriate thing to do with people who break the law. I mean, first of all, probably 80% of the people in our prisons shouldn't be there. We don't need to build new prisons. We need to do something more intelligent about drug laws, for one thing. Most prisoners have substance abuse issues, and the war on drugs is a ridiculous mockery of anything. And then we would only have prisons for people who are really dangerous. As it is, 70% of the people who enter a prison are there for nonviolent offenses. And yet the media gives, you know, people like John Walsh and stuff give the public the idea there's these depraved monsters just waiting to prey on us. There's screwed up, dysfunctional, you know, luckless people who don't know how to organize their lives. But 70% of them are nonviolent when they get into prison, but that doesn't mean that 70% of them are nonviolent when they get out of prison.
Right.
So the first thing we have to do is say prisons are a last resort when somebody is really dangerous, not a first resort for somebody who breaks the law or gets themselves in trouble or uses drugs. There's just more intelligent ways to deal with that.
You know, this whole obsession with law and order, is just remarkable to me, how big an obsession that can become in a society. Like right now, the immigration thing. Well, they're breaking the law. You know, or all kinds of laws that have no right still being on the books are the cause of all kinds of nonviolent people going to prison.
Yeah.
It's such a vindictive society with such a legalistic morality.
But see, the vindictiveness and the legalism are instruments. I mean, there's people making money off prisons. There's people making big money and power, like the guards unions. The CCPOA in California runs the California prison system. And so you get all these political agendas and financial agendas in there, and then those forces use the media. The media is a sap for it. Use the media to frighten the public, and you know, into all this legalism and, you know, harshness and everything. It's just, I mean, it's Dylan's old song. They're only a pawn in the game. You know, there's this. Prisons are wrong responses to people who break the laws, and prisons harm people. They don't help people. I deal with in a field where I'm trying to help people help themselves against the influence of the prison system, you know, not aided by it at all. And thousands of people do that, and they become strong, beautiful people. I mean, several of my best friends are convicted killers who've done long sentences. They've gotten out. They're working in halfway houses. They're working in substance abuse treatment centers. They're working with at-risk youth. I mean, people really do change, and we don't want to believe that, but people really, really change. People can be horrible people and become some of the best people you've ever met, and more motivated than the average citizen to help out, to pay back, you know, by helping out.
Speaking of motivation, your most recent book suggests that compassion is at the root of happiness. Do you think that this is the answer to the problems in the prison system too?
I spent 3 years in retreat many years ago reading all the Bibles of the world's religions, and I mean, if I had to come up with one word that binds all the world's religions together, it's unselfishness. And, you know, compassion would be the positive terminology for unselfishness. And it's natural. It's something that is in us. And what obstructs it is self-protection, fear, and greed, and things like that. So what all the religions are about is overcome this personal selfish agenda and open up to your own natural compassion and love one another as I have loved you, and love your neighbor as yourself. See how that works. And so you know, people think, boy, that must be a tough sell in the brutality of prisons. But because prisons are so brutal, if I really embody something, if I'm not just talking about it off the top of my head, if my whole life really embodies and expresses something that is better than the selfishness and brutality and fear of prison, people are desperate to touch something real like that, you know, and they've in the 33 years I've been doing this, they've absolutely tested me and, you know, put me through the, you know, put me through the ringer, because they want to know, is this real or are you just coming in to just, you know, just jive us? And when they see that my life is passionately about what I'm talking with them about, they're my best friends.
Speaking of passion and a sense of personal mission, you've said that people have to feel a connection to the larger community and then pick a piece that they want to work with. How does any given individual come to know what their piece of the puzzle should be?
I really believe in the benefits of spiritual practice, of taking reasonable care of body, mind, and spirit on a daily basis, and that life then, you know, drops a series of breadcrumbs in front of us, and one step leads to another and another, and we find the right areas for ourselves. I don't think we have to sit down with a blank slate and say, oh my God, what should I do? I have no idea what to do in life. I feel like spend a little bit of time every day being simple and quiet, like meditation. Keep your body in decent shape and do a little bit of spiritual study or reading that inspires you, and follow your life. Look at it with a quiet mind and an unfearful heart. Begin to listen to what your life is telling you and try something a little bit in this direction, try something a little bit in that direction, and soon we find ourselves in an arena that's really right for us. And like I said, I never sat down and said, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to prison work. I just opened myself and said, this looks like something that's useful, and I've been following that same thing for 33 years now, and it's become my life.
So how did that come into your consciousness, that you were supposed to do this, because you have devoted most of your life?
My sister's husband was in prison. I visited him. I got moved by the brutality and the plight of prisoners, and I just opened myself to it. I just said, what could I do? What could I do to help out in this environment?
You know, even the books that you've written have come to you like, according to the breadcrumb analogy that you just gave us, that basically you've been approached by saying, hey, you know, we want to publish your book, or we want to make a book out of your essays.
I believe life works. I really do. And I was born and raised like any other American to focus on leadership and being strong and all of that. And now I'm almost 60. I take great joy in following instead of leading. I follow what Native Americans call the good red road. I follow the precepts. I follow the commandments. I follow the breadcrumbs, because I really believe that if we're in tune, that life works and leads us on.
Now, in your book, It's a Meaningful Life, which is one of several books that have been published in the past several years, you suggest some spiritual practices that are geared towards modern life in the West. Can you describe some of these and tell us how you came up with them?
Well, as I said earlier, I spent 3 years in retreat long ago reading all the world's Bibles, and I was trying to look for the common themes, and three of the themes that we created Human Kindness Foundation around jumped out at me, that are in every religion. Be careful of your level of materialism. Be cautious. Don't overdo it. So we call that simple living. The second principle that jumped out at me from all of them was dedicate your life to something bigger than your own personal success, your own personal happiness. The Jews say an undedicated life is not worth living. The Tibetans, Buddhists say the source of all happiness is cherishing others more than myself. So dedicated life to some sort of service, beauty, whatever. And the third principle that jumps out from all the great traditions is spend a little bit of time every day being silent and still. You know, it takes time to be deep. So make sure you're taking a little bit of time every day to be deep and quiet and humble. So I think that once people begin to work with practices like that, how do I live a little bit more simply? That's the practices in Meaningful Life, you know, looking at modern American culture. What would it mean to live a little more simply, to be cautious of my level of materialism? What would it mean to dedicate my life to something larger than me and my family? What would it mean to take a little bit of time to be alone and quiet every day? So a lot of the practices that you're talking about that are in there are just more, you know, specific, like, well, here's what we could do with TV in our family. Here's what we could do with, you know, with clothing, with, you know, if you buy a new shirt, look in your closet and give one away. If you buy a new CD, look over your rack and give one away, so that you don't wind up with clutter. You know, your life kind of stays a little bit lean. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, certainly for prisoners, the simplification advisement is kind of taken care of for them.
Not really.
Really? Okay.
Because if you're feeling deprived because of all that is taken away from you in prison, your energy can be trying to get more all the time.
Still attached.
Like Hogan's Heroes, always right. running scams around Colonel Klink. You know, I mean, that can be all your energy, is trying to have more, get more, because you're deprived. So being content with wearing all blue every day, being content with the little bit of food that you're given and all, is a whole different state of mind than feeling deprived.
Boy, contentment is not something that is a real popular virtue in our society.
You know, but my son's life changed in one conversation that he had with a Guatemalan girl when he was about 20. He was volunteering for summer in this village in Guatemala, a very, very poor village. And he was sleeping on a mud floor with this whole Guatemalan family and all that. And he was having a conversation with this 20-year-old girl his age. And he was asking her if she'd ever tasted various kinds of food, because their diet in that village was beans and tortillas three times a day. That was it. And they're grateful for that. And so he asked her if she'd ever had pizza. And she said, my parents took me to Guatemala City once and I had pizza. And ever had ice cream? You know, I think I've had ice cream. And he asked her about all these different foods. And then he asked her the question that changed his life. He said, if you could have your pick of any food you've ever tasted, what would you have as your diet? And she said, beans and tortillas. And it changed him. It was like a Zen koan. It stopped his mind. You know, he just thought, because he had finally met somebody his age who was actually content with something modest. And he didn't know anybody that he grew up with who would eat beans and rice twice a day for 2 days, let alone 7 days a week.
Right.
And that's her favorite food, because she's not struggling against her circumstance. And our consumer culture encourages us, brainwashes us to always struggle to want something different than what we've got, because that's how you spend money.
Right.
And it's a killer.
The grass is always greener.
Oh, it's just horrible. Our kids are the most angry, violent kids who have ever been born.
You know, it's incredible to have conversations like this, and we could go on for a long time, and we're just about out of time here. And I want to make sure that before we go, you can tell people how they can find out more about the Prison Ashram Project, about the books that you've written, and in general, the work that your organization is doing.
Well, it's easily done. Our website is simply humankindness.org, just all one word, humankindness.org. We have an online catalog of all of my books and CDs and some other things. And of course, my books are at Amazon and things like that. And, you know, it's available. It's out there. And there's a lot of information at our website about what we do and what other people are doing and that sort of thing. And there's my schedule of this tour is on our website. And I'll be traveling for, I don't know, maybe the next year or two, speaking in different places, both inside and outside of prisons. And people can kind of keep up with where they might run into me that way.
So would you consider yourself to be a karma yogi?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Karma yoga is the yoga of service, and I find myself in that lineage, and I feel that I'm a Christian, and I think that's convenient for being in a predominantly Christian culture. As a Christian, I can speak out against the offensive form of Christianity that I see in our pop culture. It's become a loud, proud, I'm saved, you're not kind of religion. And speaking from within Christianity, being offended by that is very different from saying, I'm a Hindu or a Buddhist, and this is what I have against Christianity. I am a Christian. I have a doctorate in theology from Chicago Theological Seminary, United Church of Christ. And I speak as a Christian, saying it offends me to see how we practice Christianity in this country.
I'm saved, and you're left behind, and you'll be tortured by
Jesus. Well, yeah, the whole
Jesus.
Idea of the rapture, you know, that part of the rapture is that we get to gloat over looking at all the suckers left on earth. That's the antithesis of the Christ impulse.
It's amazing. Well, I want to thank you, Bo, very much for being on Pathways this Sunday morning.
My pleasure.
And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We've been visiting with Bo Lozoff, who's the author of several books, including It's a Meaningful Life, It Just Takes Practice. And he's the co-founder of the Human Kindness Foundation and its award-winning Prison Ashram Project. We're happy that you tuned in today, and we hopefully will have you with us every Sunday morning at this time, when either Tom Park or myself invite you to join us for a visit with selected leaders in personal and cultural transformation. On behalf of KBOO FM 90.7 and the Pathways program. This is Paul O'Brien signing off. And, of course, I have to give credit to one of our sponsors for the show. And in that regard, I should tell you that Pathways is sponsored in part by Tarot.com, providers of do-it-yourself astrology, tarot, I Ching, and numerology on the Internet at Tarot.com. That's Tarot.com. Thanks again for tuning in.